This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast and subscribe. Well, we've got a great show for you today. We've got a returning friend. I am very stoked about it. This is a name you'll recognize from episode 211 entitled A Scientific Approach to Real Estate Investing. I'm talking about Neil Bawa. And Neil is that show was one of the most listened to podcasts that we've ever had. Great information, but a guy who has taken technology and used it to do amazing things in real estate investing, specifically in the multifamily space. Neil, you know, he brings an extremely strong strategic and operational experience to his role as the CEO of Grow Capitus Investments. Neil sources, negotiates, and acquires commercial properties across the U.S. for 500-plus investors. Current portfolio, over 2,000 units, projected to be at 3,000 in 12 months. The portfolio includes multifamily and student housing properties in 9 U.S. states. Neil is a nationally recognized in-demand speaker at multifamily events, IRA events, and meetups across the country. Nearly 4,000 students attend his multifamily seminar series each year, and hundreds attend his Magic of Multifamily boot camps. Neil's nationwide meetup network, and we talked about this in his interview before, just an amazing group that took off in the Bay Area. Multifamily University has thousands of members. Neil leads Grow Capitus Investments, where he is driving the syndication and acquisition of multifamily properties. Well, Neil, welcome back to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Thank you, Bill. It's terrific to be back. It's always fun to be on your show, especially because I think you have the best radio voice amongst all the podcasters that I have been on. So it's fabulous to be back with you. And the last time I was there, I got incredible amount of outreach and comments from your audience. So it feels good to be back.
Hey, it's great having you back. I always learn just tons of stuff whenever you're on. You have a sort of an out of the box approach to, you know, everything from entrepreneurialism to real estate to you name it. You really do look at things from different standpoints, and I think it has really done well for you. I mean, I think last time I interviewed you, you had 1,000 properties, and now you're going to be coming up on 3,000 here. This is amazing, and I am just dying to talk to you today. I understand. Well, maybe you could just kind of give us just a little in your own words, you know, just sort of what you've been doing since, gosh, we talked, that was back in June of 2018. What you've been doing since then?
Well, I've been applying technology. I've always felt that there's a place for more technology in commercial real estate. Commercial real estate is one of these areas that really hasn't been penetrated as much by core technology as other areas. It's still kind of the old boys network and people sort of doing the same sort of stuff based on gut feel and my experience and my knowledge, rather than looking at big data and coming up with these incredible insights that power companies like Amazon and Google and Microsoft and Apple, right? These companies are able to make, you know, be worth $1 trillion each by using data analysis. Why wouldn't it apply to multifamily? So that became my mission and passion. And I've been implementing that, also implementing outsourcing. I've hired a massive army in the Philippines to optimize my properties. And I was showing you a little bit of that before the interview, you know, basically just reaching out to tens of thousands of tenants. So I've been in full experiment mode, Bill. I've been trying my technology tricks that I've learned in my 20-year tech career and saying, does this work in real estate? Oh, it works. Oh, this one works even better than it did back in technology, right? Those sorts of things. And it's enabled me to grow my portfolio very, very quickly. We bought or built $187 million worth of multifamily last year. And what's more important than that is that the amount of cash that we are distributing to investors went up 3x in 2019 compared to 2018 using techniques like that army in the Philippines, optimizing our properties by bringing in renters, you know, those sorts of things. So I really feel more proud of the fact that our distributions to investors have jumped to all-time highs than necessarily buying more properties.
That's awesome. And I remember when you were on before, I just really latched on to the way that you brought new tenants. I think you talked about the apartment building you bought in South Side of Chicago, I think.
Yep.
And how you took this whole, you know, finding good tenant thing in an area that's probably not the best part of town, and then trying to bring good people in to an apartment that you acquired, and just the turnaround and everything that happened, all again using technology and outsourcing, and just blew me away. But I've seen now that you've applied a lot of those, you know, it's a lot of that same approach to finding good markets, mm-hmm. you know, projecting, you know, things that are going to happen economically and so forth. And so that's what I'm looking forward to today, is kind of hearing, you know, what kind of an outlook you have. I know we're talking that there's going to be a correction somewhere. We just don't mm-hmm. know when. This is the longest period that we've ever gone without a correction in the history of this country. Things are bound to happen. It's just, I think economic science here, but how do we position ourselves and what does that mean for us as investors and maybe, you know, moving a little bit into, you know, where are the markets, sort of the best markets to be in this time of the year and so forth?
I love that. I love talking macroeconomics and its impact on real estate, because it's a huge impact and people really don't think about it. We're so in the weeds all the time that we don't think about the things that have massive impact. We don't think about how we could actually, in case of a recession, what could we do? And there are so many things that in real estate that we can do to guard against these sorts of things that happen. So yeah, I think that's a great place to start. To me, I think, you know, if I want to answer your question, maybe, you know, a little bit holistically, if you're looking at how real estate's going to do in 2020, and if you're looking to understand whether there's going to be a recession this year, what are the typical sort of things that you need to know about? Well, what's the economy doing? Because real estate demand is very tied to jobs, inflation, consumer spending, and interest rates, right? So those are the four things that are really the key drivers of demand. Right. If all of a sudden we lose 2 million jobs, our demand drops off. So it's not okay to say, well, we have an undersupply of single family homes. Well, you lose 2 million jobs, you have an oversupply. So the economy is always the foundation of everything that we do in real estate. And when we're looking at the economy in 2020, the key theme for 2020 is that recession risk is definitely waning, but an economic slowdown is extremely likely. So at this point, there have been three or four things that have happened that have reduced the risk of that recession. The first one being the Federal Reserve's extremely accommodative interest rate policy. When all of us, you and me and everybody else, was talking about, oh my God, interest rates are going to go up like crazy. Well, in 2019, we've seen significant declines in interest rates, right? So our Fed funds rate today is 1.75. It was 2.5 a year ago. Everyone was projecting it would go up 0.75 point, and it went down 0.75 point. Now, I'm not going to talk about what the long-term bad impact of that is going to be, because there's a long-term bad impact of that. But in the short term, it massively reduced the risk that 2020 would be a recession year. It does affect growth, though. So it is likely that growth could slow a little bit. And when I look at all the forecasts, right, the Federal Reserve says, you know, 2019 consumer spending at 2.4, we're now forecasting 2%. Real GDP was at 2.2, we're now forecasting 1.8. Inflation was at 2.1, we're forecasting 1.7. None of those surprise me. They're all kind of more of the same that we saw in 2019. We're going to see a slowdown in 2020, because slower consumer spending, slower GDP, lower inflation. But I think that we've done enough to avoid a recession in 2020, right? And I'll talk about what happens if I'm wrong. But I think that we've done enough to avoid a recession and at least for 2020 achieve a slow kind of muddling through stuck in traffic type of growth that we're likely to see. And it's definitely going to have a negative impact on real estate, but not as negative as a recession would have had. That's kind of my feel for the moment. And one last data point I want to give you there, Bill, is one of the big X factors in 2019 was the trade war. Well, for the moment, it appears that things have cooled down because, you know, Trump and Lee were engaged in you know, my gun's bigger than yours, if you know what I mean, war. And they seem to have backed off quite a bit. So we just signed, you know, phase A, and we're now looking to negotiate phase B. So for the moment, it seems like there's some rational thought being applied there. And that was the big X factor. And that's another positive today compared to 6 months ago. So I do think that we've got a slowdown coming. I don't think that we've got a recession coming.
Got it. And what do you think is going to happen to real estate prices in the year ahead here?
So when I look at the forecast, right, I've looked at forecasts from five sources. I looked at the, you know, Today Magazine, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, Mortgage Bankers Association, and the NAR, the National Association of Realtors. And their forecasts are all pretty consistent. They're all forecasting a very small amount of a real estate price growth. So about maybe 2 to 3% real estate price growth and rents growing about 2%. Now, these numbers sound awful to those of us that have become spoiled by the last 6 or 7 years. But I want to remind you that 2% growth in you know, home prices, 2% growth in rents is actually the long-term trend. If you look at the last 50 years, that's what prices look like, 2 or 3%, you know, annualized increases. So for the moment, because of the slowdown, we're kind of coming back to the norm that we used to have, you know, in this country before, you know, 2000 and you know, all kinds of things going crazy after that. So I think that we're looking at slow growth. We're looking at interest rates that are in the 3.6% for the 30-year fixed. That's what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are projecting, which is decent, right? So you've got interest rates low enough for people to be able to buy. But you're not going to see a lot of growth and in, you know, in prices. And a lot of that is because of affordability, especially in California, but also in other kind of expensive, you know, coastal states. The issue is not that people don't want to buy. There's plenty of buyers. Their ability to buy the homes that are in the marketplace today that are available for sale is restricted despite, you know, low interest rates by affordability, because we've had such huge increases in home prices that now we've reached the point where, you know, only a certain percentage of those people can buy. So I'm predicting maybe a 2 to 3% home price increase. Now, California may not get that. So I think that Southern California might see 2 to 3%. Northern California might see a price decline. And the last 12 months have been completely 100% flat for home prices in the Bay Area. And I think that we're going to see another flat year in the San Francisco Bay Area in the next 12 months.
That's kind of the same thing happening down here in Southern Cal too. It's mm-hmm. There has been decline. And so, yeah, that sounds about right. What about in terms of looking at it from, you know, like just focus maybe on the multifamily, for example, are we going to look at the same kind of participation that you'd see from international and institutional investors, maybe heavier investing from those groups? Do you think it's going to stay about the same?
I think it's going to stay about the same. But when I say that, I want to point out what stay about the same means. So international investors have been pouring money into the United States because this is very crystal clear. This is a fact. The United States is unquestionably the best looking pig in the international pigsty. No pig out there looks as good looking as the U.S. pig does. And the reason for that is we've got actual growth. I mean, look at our GDP. Our GDP actually works. Our debt is only at 100% of GDP, which, you know, we're worried about. But you've got other countries out there at 200%. China's at 300%. Japan's at 250% debt to GDP. Japan's got a declining population. China's got real estate bubbles much bigger than ours. So you look at all these other pigs in the pigsty, and then all of a sudden we look much nicer, right? And we are the only country, the only major industrialized nation that has managed to keep interest rates positive, where you've got the Eurozone practically at zero. I mean, I heard about something recently that I first thought was a joke, Bill, but I want to tell you why this is important to answer your question. There are banks, and I think this happened in either Sweden or Norway. So there's a bank there that is giving you a 30-year mortgage at under 0%. So if you buy a $400,000 home, right, the bank will actually end up, you don't have to repay the $400,000. So there's no interest interest at all, but you don't even repay the principal. So instead of $400,000, you repay them $396,000, right? And you go, how could the bank possibly be making money if you're going to return on a $400,000 loan, if you're only going to return $396,000? Well, they'll make money fine, firstly, because they're charging fees. And secondly, because they're picking up money at negative 1% from the market. And they're pretty much giving it to you at flat, at their cost. So they're still making that 1% arbitrage. When a world looks like this, and the U.S. doesn't look like it, well, we tend to attract a huge amount of capital. So the last 2 years, an insanely large amount of capital has been flowing from pension funds in the Eurozone, Japan, and other places where interest rates are effectively at zero, and we have positive interest rates. We are actually, you know, today a treasury bond is about, a 10-year bond is about 2%. Well, a 10-year treasury bond in Germany is negative. And so money is flowing towards us. I don't think that stops, because I think that there's very little indication that these economies, other economies, are going to get better in the short term. So I think that money keeps coming. A lot of it goes to multifamily. It used to go to single family when it was the Chinese bringing in the money. But who are the big buyers today? It's the Canadians. It's the Saudis. It's the Singaporeans. Singaporeans have really picked up because it's a very rich country. So it's not really a huge amount of Chinese money anymore. Chinese money preferred single family. The money from other countries tends to prefer multifamily. So I don't expect that to reduce. I also don't expect it to go up in 2020. So about the same.
Hmm. So as far as investors, as they're looking ahead here, I know that there's some that are thinking, well, you know, I need to be more cash, you know, intensive here, and that I should be setting aside a fair amount of cash should there be, you know, reduction in prices so that I can get those great deals. I don't want to tie up everything. What's sort of your thought in, you know, the year, the 2 years down the road?
So my honest answer to you is this. At this point, the Fed seems to have learned a lot of things from the previous recessions. They're very sensitive to preventing a recession because the world economy is fundamentally so much weaker than, you know, past recessions 10 or 20 years ago. They're doing a lot to prevent a recession. I think that this whole I'm going to sit on the sidelines approach may not work well for you. I want to remind people that the recession ended in 2009, right? And the primary effects ended in 2010. And since 2011, I've been hearing people that about sitting on the sidelines. In 12, there were people sitting on the sidelines. Then in 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19, there were people talking about sitting in the sidelines. And still, that recession that we've been waiting for the last 6 years hasn't come. You've got to understand that, unlike the past, recessions now are being artificially prevented by federal banks. And for the moment, they seem to know what they're doing. So I would not leave my money on the sidelines. I think that this is, you know, for better or for worse, the market that you want to live in. Your money on the sidelines is losing because of inflation. You're at minus 2% anyway. You might as well jump in and look at the marketplace. But you have to be careful where you go today. Whether it's single family or multifamily, you have to be way more careful than 2 or 3 years ago. If you don't think that you have the knowledge or the experience, yes, maybe leave the money on the sidelines and wait for a correction. Just don't hold your breath for that correction, because I don't think it's coming in 2020.
Mm, I love it. How about, I know that there's a national market, although I honestly believe it's really just a whole bunch of individual regional markets. But in terms of investing and where to invest, I know places like California, New York, I want to really avoid. A lot of the coastal places, especially those that are introducing rent control at, just crazy pace. Where do you think is the good places to move in that regard?
Mm-hmm. So, I think you started it off right, right? So Rentzilla is kind of rearing its ugly head again. It's a populist measure. The biggest benefit of Rentzilla is that politicians get elected when they use it in their campaigns. It doesn't work. It's never worked. San Francisco and Oakland have rent control and are two of the most expensive markets in the country. New York has had rent control for 30 years, and it is one of the most expensive markets in the country. So there's no actual evidence that rent control ever works, but it does get politicians elected. And given the populist sort of wave that we are part of, I expect that it will grow and other states will implement it. So my advice is this. I am a liberal Democrat. Cut me and I'm going to bleed blue. I do not invest in Democrat states. I do not invest in real estate in Democrat states, right? I don't mind investing in tech firms in California, but I will not invest in real estate in these blue states that are, all of them are gearing up for some form of rent control or the other over the next year or two. So landlords are under attack. They're just less likely to be under attack in high growth, southwestern states. And I'm not suggesting that all Republican states are good for real estate investment. But when I look at the landscape today, I think that there is no two ways about saying that southwestern states are inexpensive, they're affordable, they have the housing, and they have the population growth and the job growth. California today is not at the top of the pack when it comes to job growth. We're in the middle. There's other states like North Carolina, Texas, Florida, Georgia that are doing better on the jobs, and they're doing way better on population growth, because California is losing large numbers of people to these states, especially millennials who are cash-strapped, are moving. For the last 9 years, the city that has had the most number of people moving in is Atlanta, Georgia. Other cities that have seen a lot of people come in are, cities like Orlando, Dallas, Austin, even Houston has seen a lot of people move from here. So those cities have great population growth, and that's driving their real estate. And today, it's more profitable. But having said that, though, the other people know this. What I'm saying is not some magic secret thing. And so the prices in those areas have also been going up. So where last year I would say, yep, invest in Dallas or invest in Austin, I'm not so sure about that anymore because prices have gone up there. Last year, I would say Orlando, Nashville, Denver are good bets. And this year, I'm like, no, prices have gone up a great deal there. So, Boise, Idaho, prices have gone up a great deal. So where do you invest, right? Where's the right place to invest today? Well, firstly, I feel that you should, if you're willing to look outside California, you have to look at North Carolina. Today, when I look at statistics and I look at numbers all the time. If you go to multifamilyu.com, I have a presentation that has over 100 cities profiled. When I look at it, I have to say, I don't know what it is that North Carolina's politicians are doing, but whatever it is, it's awesome and everyone else should copy it. because I look at the list of cities that show up in my statistics, and it's Raleigh and Charlotte and Winston-Salem and Asheville. So many of their metros show up at the top of my list. So, and housing is inexpensive in places like Raleigh and Charlotte. You can sell your property in California and buy three of them in a suburban part of Raleigh and Charlotte. You don't want to go to downtown, but 20 minutes from Charlotte downtown, you can buy something very reasonable. And it's going to cash flow maybe not at 8 or 9% a year. It's going to cash flow more at 6 or 7. But keep in mind, these states have great appreciation potential. So you want to take a look at those options, right? And if you don't like North Carolina, then take a look at Jacksonville in Florida. That's a strong market. If you don't like that, look at Arizona, really friendly to landlords. Phoenix is very hot, so it might be a little late. But what about the markets around Phoenix? Gilbert, Chandler, Mesa, Arizona in particular is an absolute favorite of mine because it's a very fast-growing city. Rents are still reasonable. Home prices are reasonable. And if you still feel that is too expensive, then look at Tucson, which is about, I'd say, about 80, 90 miles away from Phoenix and is a strong market. Arizona State University has 55,000 students there, so that market's growing really well. They also are growing in the healthcare area and the healthcare tourism area. Those are strong markets to look at. You like Texas? Look at San Antonio. That's a market that's developing a great deal. So I still think that there's a lot of good markets around the U.S., Bill.
Are you looking also at, you know, sort of secondary, tertiary markets as well, or are you sticking primarily to major MSAs?
Well, I'm going to say something that's going to get me beaten up by a few people, but I believe the primaries have, today in 2020, the primaries have become more risky. And in general, the primaries have always been the safest. But look at price increases. Denver prices have increased by 55 to 60%. So I think Colorado Springs is safer. I think that, you know, practically any city in a 100-mile radius of Denver is safer than Denver itself. Same thing for Nashville. Nashville's gone up 50-plus percent. So Chattanooga is a safer bet than Nashville is. Even Memphis, in my mind, is a better bet. So you've got to look at these secondary markets. You know, obviously, tertiary markets are a little more dangerous. Even in California, in my mind, Riverside is a better bet. The entire Inland Empire is a better bet than Los Angeles at this point in time, because the difference between prices and rents between Los Angeles and the Inland Empire is so huge that a massive amount of population is being driven into the desert there.
Now, are you still finding deals? I know you use data metrics a lot, analytics, mm-hmm. and do you in your research, you find areas where you can actually, you know, buy some properties under market value still in this economy?
I have not found that to be the case. I think that today in 2020, we are in the ninth year of a real estate expansion. And if you're buying a property under market, then the overwhelming chances are that that property deserved to be under market, right? So there's something wrong with it, something unusual. And you're probably going to figure that out within 3 months of buying it, that it wasn't worth the price that you were paying for it. So I don't see a lot of areas in the U.S. that is the case. Having said that, if there was one area that you have a better chance of that, it is the Rust Belt, Indiana, Kansas City, St. Louis. You've got Memphis itself. I think
Ohio.
Pretty much Ohio, right? So you've got Dayton, Ohio, Cincinnati, Cleveland. There are definitely bargains there, but be aware that you should be looking at population growth before you go into these places. Cincinnati, I think, is a safer bet than Cleveland because it doesn't gain population, but it doesn't lose any. Whereas Cleveland's been consistently losing population. Dayton has been consistently losing population. So I think Cincinnati is a good bet. Philadelphia, Philly is a good bet for if you want to look at cheaper prices and if you're focused on, you know, finding deals that are below market. I think Philly still has a lot of housing that has potential. And while the city was losing population in the past, it seems to have flattened out for now. So those are definitely some places where you can get deals, no doubt, right? I would just say stay away from dangerous markets like Detroit. because Detroit does really well in an expansion and then just gets completely hammered in every recession. And I mean, I don't think 2020 is a year, but I do think that a recession is close. And going into momentum markets like Detroit, it may be a little bit too late for this cycle.
Got it. Good points. Where do you see the, looking at our audience here, primarily, folks 50 plus in age, and some are approaching retirement, some are in retirement. And where would you see it be sort of the smartest places for them to invest right now in the real estate realm? And that's a pretty broad realm. I mean, we've got, everything from REITs to single family homes to mobile home parks to, storage and all these different areas. Where do you think is sort of a good place for folks that, again, they've got this nest egg and these funds that they don't want to risk. And what would you say is sort of a good place for them to go?
Well, firstly, I think multifamily is more stable. I want to remind people that while single family home prices fell 29% in 2008, multifamily home prices didn't even fall 10%. Multifamily rents only declined 1 year in 2009. They were positive in 8, they were positive in 10. Why? Because people need a place to live. And when you go into a recession, millions of people will lose their homes. And some will go live with mom and dad or live in a car or in a mobile home park, but the majority are going to end up in an apartment. We are turning into landlord nation, and there's no two ways about that. I do feel that workforce housing, right, not necessarily like C-, but B- and C+ workforce housing is a fairly good place to continue to invest in. Prices have gone up there, so cash flow has gone down, but I think that that's definitely a good market to invest in. I also think that if it's a superstar market like Phoenix, then you should be looking at new construction projects there. I do new construction projects there, and I've had a terrific response. And I have a fairly I have an older audience that's investing with me, and they like that particular market. Beyond what I do, I mean, I think that self storage is a market to look at. But I would say rather than investing in individual projects, you might want to look at self-storage REITs. I think there's now some mobile home REITs coming into the marketplace, so you might want to look at those because I do think that there's trends there. I mean, what if people can't afford to live in apartments? They've still got to go somewhere. And the two places they go to is, well, they downsize their apartment and stick a bunch of their stuff in storage. Or they downsize to mobile home parks, right? So that area unquestionably will continue to grow. During recessions, mobile home parks will suffer because of delinquency. A lot of tenants don't pay, but that's a short-term thing. Once you get out those tenants, the cash flow resumes. So I think those are two great areas. I don't work in mobile home parks. I enjoy multifamily. I do public storage projects, not very often though. So I think those are two good areas, but certainly mobile home parks in my mind are a good place to look, especially if you believe that there's going to be a recession in 2020.
And could you just define for our listeners what you would say, who are the workforce housing tenants?
So the person who drives a bus, who works at Starbucks, who works at the airport, people in retail, that all of those people are now workforce housing. And unfortunately, and this is sad, teachers now are being driven more and more into workforce housing. So workforce housing is basically an apartment complex that has very little amenities. Might have a very small 20-foot by 20-foot gym, but that's really about it. You've got fairly small apartments, 8-foot ceilings, older properties, 30 or 40 years old. Some of them have been refurbished, so they look a little nicer on the inside. But these are, older apartments, and we've got millions and millions and millions of these older apartments. And the reason why these are better is if you look at rent growth in the last 6 years, it's not the good-looking Class A. It's not the okay-looking Class B. The highest rent growth in each of the last 6 years has been Class C. Once again, we're becoming a landlord nation. People are living in apartments simply because they have no hope of owning a home. They can't even put a down payment together, let alone be able to pay the monthly payment. And so there's more and more demand for apartments as years go by. Yes, we're building plenty of new apartments, so there's some incoming supply coming in. But that incoming supply that's coming in is coming in at $1,800, $1,900 a unit. Not in California. In California, it's more like $4,000 a unit.
Really?
Right. Whereas these older properties are at $1,000 a unit. So that incoming supply is not an apples to apples. No one in America, anywhere, in any shape or form, today is building apartments and renting them at $1,000. No one is able to do that because the cost of construction is out of control. China is building a New York-sized city every 3 months. Every 3 months, they're building something the size of New York. They're consuming their own steel. They're consuming their own concrete. And because of that, the cost of construction in the U.S., the labor and the material has gone up, especially the materials have gone up a great deal. So no one can build an apartment complex at $1,000 or $1,100 a month in rent. And as a result, those classy apartments that exist, there's a finite supply of them, and that supply isn't getting any higher, but the percentage of Americans that need to live in them gets higher every year. This doesn't change because a recession is coming, right? Let's say that 2020 is a recession year. Can I segue into that and give you kind of my feel for what happens if there is a recession?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's ways to get around the recession. Here's what is likely to happen. So let's say that second half of this year is a recession. A recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. So here's what I would forecast happens. You know, you get into the recession, the Fed, you know, announces a recession. And what's the first thing that the Federal Reserve does? It's going to cut interest rates. It's probably going to cut them from where we are today at 1.75 all the way to zero, right? So they could do 7 interest rate cuts. Doesn't help anything in the short term because it takes them about 9 months to kind of wind their way through the economy. But in the short term, what it does is rent growth goes down, and all those people that are holding apartments, they stop distributing money to their investors, like me. What they do is they start focusing on filling their properties, which isn't that hard because now as the recession starts, people are losing jobs. They're losing homes. Every recession, more than 1 million people lose their homes. Well, they start moving over to the apartments, and because the apartment owners like me are not focused so much on raising the rents, they're focused on occupancy. They take all these people in and they keep their occupancy up. It's not a great time for us. The delinquency goes up a bit because the people that lose their jobs are living in apartments. We have to process them out. But luckily, I don't invest in California, so it doesn't take me 6 to 12 months to get rid of tenants that are not paying. It takes me 6 to 12 weeks to get rid of them. And in some states like Arizona, it only takes 3 weeks. So once I go through that transition, my property stabilizes. I'm able to pay my mortgage. And wait for the end of the recession, because that is going to be really awesome. When the recession ends, it takes the Federal Reserve usually 1 to 2 years to even think about raising interest rates. The last one ended in 2009. We didn't end up raising rates until 6 years later. Even if the next one's mild, it's going to take him 2 years. But imagine that when the recession ends and people start getting their jobs back, you can start raising rents at these apartment properties immediately. And then you can refinance at some absurdly low interest rate because the Fed has cut interest rates 6 or 7 times. That actually creates massive amounts of cash flow that we don't even have today. And we're not in a recession today. So there's a happy ending to the apartment and landlord story, but you've got to be very prudent managing your property through the recession.
Wow. Great information, Neil. Wow. Any other things that you think might want to add here as we start to wrap up?
Yeah, I just wanted to, this is for Californians, very specific. I know a lot of your audience are Californian. A lot of you are breathing a sigh of relief saying, you know what? Rent control in California wasn't so bad. It wasn't draconian like New York. Our prices haven't fallen. I want to caution you that the approach of legislators was to get you to accept rent control first. Please, if your landlords are thinking of buying in California, please go to Google and start looking at what they're planning now. So this is a phased approach. They're fighting a war, not a battle. And I think at least 2 more tiers of rent control are coming to California within the next year and a half. So empower yourself, read about them before you make decisions about investing in California.
Well, that's a little disheartening, I'll tell you. I mean, it's got enough issues here, you know, with the homelessness and some of the major metros just falling apart, you know, add to that rent control and man, it's economically, it's just, it's not in a great, not in great shape here.
Well, California is a great state and we'll muddle along. I just don't think it's a great state for the next 10 years for real estate. I want to be very specific, right? We are still a economic powerhouse. There's lots of great reasons for people to want to live in California. So we're not going anywhere. I don't really see a Californian recession happening with the rest of the country doing well. I don't see that at all. But I do think that there's cycles and California is just not a great place to be in real estate anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be even appreciation that was always going to be a good one. But right now it looks like it may be a while before it's it's you know, good from that standpoint too. Yet I know guys are flipping here all the time and still making money. So I don't know. I guess there's always those that know how to work it. But
I would say that given that the economy still has some momentum today, flipping in California may actually still be more fruitful. I know your margins are much thinner than they were 2 or 3 years. Flipping in California still may be more fruitful than long-term holds, given where we are in the cycle, given where we are, California prices are. The chances that those prices fall a bit or plateau for 3 or 4 years is much higher than them continuing to go up.
Good information, Neil. Wow. This has been an excellent excellent interview. I love the information that you're sharing. You give us the opportunity to look at real estate from many different angles. I know we didn't talk as much about the tech applications of what you do, which are a big part of what you do and your success. But we're just going to have you back sooner. That's all there is to it. You've got a lot of neat things going on. Maybe you can share with people. One thing we didn't talk a lot about, too, is you're really busy educating a lot of people, too. And maybe you can tell us as you kind of share how people can reach you and find out more about what you do, but also about some of these great educational programs you have as well.
So I've always wanted to build the Wikipedia of real estate. I've always felt that real estate really didn't have a place where people can go in and do deep dive learning without being sold some expensive package or some monthly subscription. And so it took me a long time, but I have lots and lots of friends in real estate. And so we built a website called multifamilyu.com. That's multifamily followed by the letter u.com. And we do 50 deep dive webinars there every year. And those are, even though the website says multifamily, they're on everything. There's stuff there on storage. There's stuff there on the legal aspects, taxation. We just did one on taxation and 600 people showed up. We do webinars on other alternative methodologies. We do Airbnb. So the goal there really was to say, bring in experts from all over the US with a kind of a no sales pitch approach and have a deep dive webinar on their area of competency and leave these webinars on our site. So you can obviously sign up for the one that's next week, but you can also go back to the one that's recorded from last week, depending upon your aptitude. I think right now there's about 50 webinars that you can look at on the site, because I fundamentally think that we learn better in short-term format now. We're not really set up to go to three-day classes. 45-minute webinars are really consumable. A lot of people are actually listening to our webinars on phones as they drive to work. So check out multifamilyu.com. About a dozen of my webinars are on there. And so are my deep dives on dozens and dozens of cities in the U.S., and their prospects for real estate investment.
That's great. That's great. I think, is it Udemy or what's there? You're also on, Udemy. Yeah. We're just great information packed. These incredible seminars that just are just amazing. And, you know, I don't know. I'm very impressed with the quality of the information. Not, you know, like you said, nobody's selling anything. It's just providing great information. So those that are looking to move into multifamily, I think that that's a, you know, great place to at least get educated, at least starting out. So, so how can people reach you, Neil? What's the best way for folks to, you know, to get a hold of you and to find out what you're doing?
Well, I am very approachable. So my first name, Neil, I use the Irish spelling, N-E-A-L. So you can reach out to me at neal@multifamilyu.com or simply go to the website and fill out a form and we talk. Hundreds and hundreds of investors are benefiting from the cash flow and the upside that we give them where we optimize properties. We buy, you know, older properties, we build newer ones. If that's in an avenue that you're looking to get into, especially with 1031 benefits, then I'd love to talk with you. Just send me an email at neal@multifamilyu.com.
That's great. Great. Wow. This has been a blast, Neil. thank you so much. And you talked about, you know, another key word here is optimization. I would love to do just a whole show on optimization because, you know, right now there are people still investing and still buying properties, but, you know, they're not necessarily pouring into those properties what they should to sort of maximize their return. And I think you, again, have made that into a science in terms of some of the things we had Anna Myers on, who's your VP there, and shared some great, great information. It was episode 299 on called Multifamily Data Science and Optimization. Just kind of touch the surface of some of the things that you're doing to take the properties you do have and turn them into, you know, cash flowing, like you said, you know, 2x or 10x or whatever it may be to really make a, you know, make a property that might just be a moderate cash flower to something that's really, really over the top. So that's stuff I definitely want to talk about in the future.
Sounds good. I'll come back anytime.
All right. Great, Neil. Well, Neil, you know our tradition here. You can't get away without giving us your best old hound dog howl. Are you ready to close us out here with your best hound dog howl?
I am ready. This is good. This is great. Ready? Here we go. Oh! How's that?
That was perfect.
All right. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being on. I really
Thanks
appreciate
so much,
it, Neil.
Bill. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Have a great day.
You bet. And I also want to thank all our old dog listeners out there, too, for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we greatly appreciate it. And please note everything that Neil talked about today, and there's a lot of good stuff there, and links as well will be included in our extensive show notes at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog, and you're going to look for the episode with Neil Bawa. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.